Hey everybody, welcome to Lutheran Answers. Sorry about the late upload. I was going to get this one up Friday, and then I got like weirdly sick. It was odd. I was really only sick for like a day, but I don't know, like I just spiked a fever out of nowhere, and I felt like I had been hit by a bus, and then I woke up the next day and I felt fine. It was truly odd, but anyway, grateful that the Lord, I guess, carried me through that quickly. But all that to say, I didn't get this episode up Friday like I wanted. So it's going up today. I think the Monday episodes perform better anyway. I was going to try around different days and see how they do, but I posted on Friday and like no one listened until Monday anyway. So I'm just going to stick to Monday mornings. It's predictable. It's nice. So this is part one of a two-part thing I'm doing. I sat down with everyone's favorite Catholic, literally Chad, and we just sort of drank and chatted and talked, and we ended up, I think, on the call for like 2.5 hours. So this is going to be the first half of that, and then in a couple of weeks, I'll go ahead and do the second half of that. I hope you enjoy. Our initial topic was going to be like dating and convincing men that they need to get married and have a ton of babies, but we ended up very quickly moving into a bunch of different subjects, and we were all around the board for about 2 hours. So this is the first half of that. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Let me know what you think. And don't forget, you can stop by shop.lutherananswers.com and check out some merch. I'll be putting up some new merch this week, so make sure you check by there. I'm going to have stickers and all kinds of cool things, so give it a look. Help support the show, shop.lutherananswers.com. Thank you, and I guess we can go ahead and hit that bump music. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Glad to hear it.
How are you?
Oh, I'm very well.
Good.
A lot to do with the Jameson.
Yeah. I'm doing the aviation gin today.
Good stuff. I've been drinking Boodles. That's been my gin for the last month. Good stuff.
So, what are we talking about?
Oh, so, I don't know, I've been reading on low self-esteem, so I was born with maximum self-esteem, and so all of my self-esteem is zero based on merit, which is, like, an internal problem that I have to deal with, but also, interacting with others, I find that they have absolutely no self-esteem, as conventionally understood, and I had no idea, and so, tearing off layers of this onion, and this applies to humility is good. We can be ecumenical and agree.
Pride is bad. Yeah.
Mm. But at the same time, the absolute contempt for themselves, or perhaps it's more passive than contempt, but a lot of people don't understand themselves to be worthy of anything.
Mm.
So the self-esteem angle and a Christian perspective on that. Yeah. This seems like something that people need.
Well, okay. So just immediately talking about that, I think a lot of people don't realize that. So when you think pride, you think, oh, I'm so great. I'm so wonderful. Of course, I'm worthy of all the stuff. But a lot of people don't realize that when you go the other way and you say, oh, I'm terrible and I'm no good and I'm not worthy of it, that's still pride. That's still pride because your focus is entirely on yourself and your own worth and your own, you know, out of yourself. That's still pride. You're still looking to you, right? As opposed to humility, which is going to be looking outward and not thinking about yourself. So humility doesn't conflict with self-esteem, but or with having a good self-esteem, but at the same time, having a really poor self-esteem is still pride. Like there's a ditch on both sides of the road.
Mm. Oh, that's a very Aristotelian way to put it. I'm glad that the Lutherans have come around on the old boy. So this manifests, you can talk about it in a dating context, but I see it even more perniciously in a parenting context. There are people who are like, well, I'd be terrible at that, therefore I'm not going to. It's like, that's not how any of this works. One, every parent kind of messes up a lot. And so if you're like, kid comes out in mint condition, and then it's my job to keep them mint condition. It's like, well, no, kids come out and they don't know how to eat.
Right.
And you can cover that. Teaching somebody how to eat, the most uninformed peasant of yore managed this. So there's really, in all of these contexts, people won't strive at all for certain things. And part of it, I mean, there are the ideological justifications that people get from the culture, like, oh, don't have kids, travel. But if you talk to people, they often say, well, I'd be bad at it. And it's like, bizarre.
Well, and like every, like, so like you said, that kids aren't born like knowing how to eat, right? Like you got to teach them, here's how you hold a fork, here's how you do the thing. But also, like, they aren't born knowing how to be good parents, right? And this is no one's born knowing how to be a good parent, and it's something that you figure out. You know, you're gonna mess up, you're gonna make mistakes, and it's I don't know. God said, "Be fruitful and multiply." Not be fruitful and multiply if you're gonna be good at it.
Mm. Yeah, he was rather broader. Yeah, as he often is.
Just do the thing, please.
But to the low self-esteem being another form of pride, it's we have some decent data on parental involvement and how this helps kids turn out. And then we did twin studies and so on. And basically, baby Einstein doesn't make a difference. A lot of things that people think are critical for their kids' eventual happiness, it's like, well, actually, so long as you meet a certain baseline, everything is, it's fun. And so taking your kid karate practice isn't going to make them successful later necessarily. But if you're enjoying it, then go for it. But it's not like people are like, oh, it costs $250,000 per kid to raise them. It's like, well, that's fake. You've got the idea that as a parent, you have a lot more. Now, a parent has tremendous influence and a parent has tremendous responsibilities. Mm-hmm. But in terms of responsibility for the ultimate outcome, it's like, well, it's very easy to overthink how much of a role that you're going to play in your child's life. I mean, how much of what either of us have done is a function of our parents?
Right.
Now, you can mess up severely. But most successes, most of the good things that happen, it's like, well, the parents provide a baseline. And then beyond that, it's on the child when they grow up.
Yeah, you can set your kids up for success. But the idea that there's a template or a formula to the perfect life. But I mean, if I take my kid to karate practice and I do this and that and the other thing, he'll be successful. But I mean, that's a lie, just like any other. That, I mean, how many lies are there that people still chase today about success and being successful? And I agree that a lot of success is doing what successful people do. You know, if every successful person on earth wakes up at 5 a.m., then maybe there's something to it and you should give it a shot. But that doesn't mean that waking up at 5 a.m. will make you successful, right? Like you should strive to imitate successful people. You know, like as Christians, we should strive to imitate the saints and our local pastor or priest. We should strive to imitate the apostles and Christ himself. But at the same time, just like going through the motions step by step isn't what's going to make you a good Christian. But maybe through the imitation, you stumble on the thing that does, right? That there's something there and you should probe it and try it and seek it and dig into it. But that doesn't mean that just following the steps rote is going to get you there.
Yes. If you're trying to get hit by lightning, you should stand in the field. But again, it still might not happen.
Right.
And have you noticed any tendency? So I've seen some of this, not in terms of people carrying it through all the way, but where people will be nervous about having kids because they're not sure if they can make sure their kid remains a Christian in today's culture. Have you seen this?
I've not seen that. I've not seen that. That is, I'll be honest though, that would be my worry. That would be my worry. What I see, what I see mostly is people are worried they can't afford it. So,
That's, I think they go with that more practically, but I think on some level, a lot of people have that anxiety. It's like, well, I'm going to have kids, but I'm not sure I can make sure that they can stay Christian, which it's like understandable, but it's also, I don't know, it feels slightly Pelagian, like, oh, I can't make sure that somebody becomes Christian. Like, well, your job is never to make sure somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, no, that's such a good point because you're right. You do worry about that, but also that is absolutely not your job. That's, and it's so funny. It's so funny because that would trip me up. But at the same time, I always laugh. I always laugh at pastors, who are like, oh, we need to do this to grow our church. We need to do that to grow our church. We got to have this kind of worship service, or we have to do this kind of outreach to grow our church. And I'm sitting here and I'm like, well, one, it's not your church. Step one. Step two, because it's not your church, you're not really the one to grow it, right? Like your job is to preach the gospel, preach Christ and Christ crucified, and love your neighbor. And, you know, God's going to do all the other stuff, the growing stuff. And I know people are going to say that that's naive and, oh, yeah, but God wants us to be practical. And, yeah, y'all can say all that, but you're wrong.
I mean, what's the point of the martyrdoms if practicality were...
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's different from prudence. So if it's... so if you have zero parishioners, it's like, well, maybe you have messed up. But right. If it's, but if you know that you're being basically competent in your proclamation of the gospel, well, you're, and then it's like, well, let's modify this for bigger market share. One seems tedious too. It's a, there's a fun story in economics where tobacco profitability went up after the advertising ban, because all that advertising does among cigarettes is cause smokers of one brand to switch to another. It doesn't get, nobody starts smoking because of advertisements. Right. They just switch brands. And so if everyone's spending, let's say, a billion a year to switch around everyone between brands, and then all of a sudden you say stop, and, well, they pocket the money, and then everyone just stays at the brand that they had before, which were relatively even market shares anyway. And so profitability went up, but it's like, well, no, I want to, and with, I assume that with churches, when it's, well, we want to change this thing to draw more people in, it's like, well, taking people from different churches that are already like that, so they come to your church, which is also like, I was like, well, one, that's cutting down the members of the church. It's like, okay, so we're all going to be the identical members.
Yeah.
And is it really important to steal market share from another place? Is that really, that's strange, that seems strange to me. If we're going to evangelize, it should
be outside.
Yes. It's shifting around everyone who already goes to church every Sunday. Obviously, we have our denominations that we want to reach 100% market share. But in the meantime, it's like, well, how many people go to church every Sunday? Those guys are the target.
Well, and it's so funny because in America, especially, we're so driven by this like idea of capitalism and free markets. Like we're so pushed by this, and it's funny because you have pastors that complain about two things at once. They complain about these two things at once. In Protestant circles, probably not in Catholic circles as much. But they complain about churches that, like parasite churches that suck away their members, right? You got, they're cannibalistic and they're eating other churches. Like there's one Lutheran church in town that's really big and has all these really big programs and they have a lot of money to throw around. And so they pull members from the smaller Lutheran churches who then complain. They complain about that they're losing members to the big church. But then those same small church pastors also want to complain about how unchristian America is becoming and how I can't believe that like 60 or 80% of young people or whatever are atheists now. And it's like, well, don't you see that the one problem is actually the solution to the other problem? Mm. Yeah, you're losing members to big box, non-denominational, wishy-washy Protestant church down the road. And we could talk about how that's a failure of catechization if you want. But really, you have a whole group of unbelieving people here that you should go evangelize, because that's where your new church members come from. They don't come from another church. They come from the people in your neighborhood that needed to pay rent this month, and you gave them the money to do that. And they said, well, why would you give us the money? Well, let me tell you. Let me tell you why we love you.
It's a... I'm frightened of evangelical big box, non-dom, whatnot. It seems strange to me. But well-catechized people do not go off into that world with the fog machines and the electric guitars.
No,
it's like,
don't.
Okay, look, if that's happening, that's kind of on the existing generation of Christians who've just not passed on the faith. When you've watered it down so much, when you've made it if a Christian doesn't look at prosperity gospel and then say, you know, I feel like there's something wrong with this.
Right.
Well, who's the ultimate villain? Who's the one at the last day who's going to have to explain why they didn't teach and allowed that to happen? Because I feel like the bad teachers, the incompetent teachers, are not going to fare much better than the outright heretics.
No, and so that's my own. This is gonna, as a Catholic, this is gonna make you cringe, but that's my interpretation of that verse where it says that teachers are judged more harshly, and like that's why I think. Because if, let's say, you teach outright heresy, right, like the president of the Mormon church, so you have all these Mormons that truly believe what you're telling them, and then they all end up in hell, okay? And they end up in hell of their own accord. They, you know, they committed their own sin and all that. But then when you, as the president of the Mormon church, then get up to the judgment before God, God's going to say, hey, in addition to all of your own sin that you committed, you also lied to these people about how they could be forgiven, and they believed you, and now they're all in hell. And, like, that's kind of on you, too. You know, it's like you're sort of carrying that.
Yeah. Corporate culpability is a thing. It's if you are an organization, if you are a church, if you are a country, it's like, well, look, you've got responsibilities to fulfill here. If you mess those up, then that is on you.
I have to say, bold words coming from a Catholic.
Oh,
Lutheran answers, everybody.
I think Lutherans and Catholics agree that that bishops are going to be punished the hardest if they go to hell. I think we can agree on that. That if is a very, it's an if that you can drive a big semi-truck over, but, yes.
Yeah, and I would also like to say that I think there's enough correct. I think there's enough correct and enough good belief that probably I would be very hesitant to say anybody's going to hell outside of an outright heretic or unbeliever. I'd be very hesitant to say someone's going to hell. But especially among the church, and I think you would agree, going the other way too, that you're going to get up to heaven and find quite a lot of Lutherans. I would say all Lutherans. I'd say we all become Lutheran once we get there. But I'm sure you would say we all become Catholic once we get there.
Yes.
You know. But I would.
So the problem with your analysis is that there's no RCIA or a. There's no Lutheran catechesis period. It's like, no, if you're instantly there, well, whereas I can point to the catechesis period and then say, well, it looks unpleasant, but,
Is this purgatory? Are you talking about purgatory?
Oh, yes. You're going to get to purgatory and it's just going to be an RCIA class.
Sounds awful. Will you do penance for me so that I can skip that?
So yes, assuming that, assuming you die first, no telling.
Dude, like, I don't want to sound, I don't know, misanthropic or like depressed or anything, but like, God, I hope so. The world is not getting any better. So,
No,
I'm not, you know, I want to, yeah, I want to spread the gospel and all, but also like, if I could just check out, that'd be great.
So I don't think today is worse than most periods. Imagine being a Christian in the 1950s. So this is the highest church attendance in American history. I mean, like, secular triumphalists will say, oh, it was all like the 1950s, like 1950s all the way back for 2,000 years. And then all of a sudden it went away, and therefore it can never come back because it was always that hegemonic. That's fake. It's like church attendance now is probably at the U.S. national history average over the years. But imagine having a Christianity that's so dominant in the culture, and yet apparently nobody's actually teaching it. It's just hegemonic, but surface level. It's enough to get people into heaven, but it's a faith that if you're on fire for is sort of odd because everyone's nominally attached. Nominal attachment is good. I hugely prefer everyone to be nominally attached because that's like, wow, you're still getting to heaven. But imagine being someone who's passionate about religion in a world where everyone pretends that they're passionate about religion, but nobody actually knows much. And imagine the level of catechesis that seems prevailed across Christianity in the 50s. It's like, these are the people who went to Woodstock. Or the people who were being catechized at this period ended up at Woodstock. So it's in a period where every Christian you meet is, I think it's fair to say, more devout than they were in the 1950s on average. It's like, if you're still a Christian in 2021 and you're under, let's say, 40, could draw the line elsewhere, but let's say under 40, you've really wrestled with this. Your parents did not set you on autopilot. Your parents should say, you should try to set your kids on autopilot, but understand that the technology's not that good yet. Everyone you've met has had to cling to the church through something and through intellectual and cultural difficulties. And so I think we've got a much wiser church today.
Yeah, and I know one time we had one of these conversations, and we talked about how amazing it was that the Anglicans were so able to instill their faith culturally, deeply, and passionately among the English people for hundreds of years. The American boomer generation did not do that. They did not do that at all. We got maybe a generation away.
And it's tying back into the self-esteem.
By the way, I tweeted out a link, so maybe someone will join us.
Circling back to self-esteem, it's not that these previous generations were better people than us. They had slightly different circumstances. They had different costs that they had to carry. It's like, well, I had 10 kids, then 8 of them died before they were 5. It's like, well, that's kind of a different cross. I'm not going to say that our mass apostasy and mass heresy in the culture is a heavier cross on a human level than the infant mortality. It's like, well, on a human level. Now, supernaturally, I might be wrong. But on a human level, I can't say, oh, well, they had it good because all of their surviving kids would remain Christian. It's like, well...
all their surviving kids, though.
Yes. It's good so far as it goes, but it's not a real consolation in human natural terms. And so when you look at the world today and you're like, okay, time for despair. It's like, well, the world's always been kind of a mess, just in different forms. And the mess that we had from, let's say, the end of World War II to the election of Donald Trump. It's like, that's one distinct mess, and now we're in a different mess. And that's not me commenting on the former president. It's like, well, look, this had roots going on. If you want to say one person caused all this, or one person could fix it, it's like, well, it seems impossible to me. But you do you.
Well, and you know, maybe too, it all feels a bit cyclical. And maybe the type of
the type of problems that we have now are... So I'm reminded of a story that was written about Martin Luther. There was the plague going around about that time, and his daughter died, and she was, I don't know, young, 13, 14, something like that. And he asks her if she's confident in her faith, and she is, and he does what we would account for last rites, and then holds her in his arms, and he's crying. His wife can't even be near. She's on the other side of the room. She can't even bear to watch her daughter die. And he's holding his little girl, and the account says that he pulls her close to his breast and says, "Please let my daughter live, but yet not my will, but yours be done." And then holds his daughter until she dies. And there's something in that your faith, like, you have to cling to God in that. You have to cling to God because there's nothing else. There's nothing else to cling to. There's nothing else to hold on to, you know. And perhaps our problems at the moment don't require us to cling to God as closely. We have our fancy science and our fancy medicine, and our infant mortality rate is very low. We have a different kind of problem these days. But that leads to apostasy. And I believe that the apostasy will naturally lead back to problems that require you to hold to God, right? It's kind of cyclical in this way.
So what I'd say is that the struggle today isn't material. The struggle today is seeing God when you don't see his works up close. Mm. Like, the way our society compartmentalizes death off. It's like, how many people over 90 do you see outside?
Right.
How many people over 70 do you see outside, honestly?
You've never been to a Lutheran church.
Oh.
That's our attendance is strictly people over 70.
Oh. So I'd say we love to hear it, but it's not like all the young people became Catholic, so it's like, oh, dear.
No, we have a ton of young people. We have a ton of young people, too.
Sounds like Latin Mass.
No one in the middle. There's no one in the middle. You're either 70 or you're like 30 and under.
Oh, we do have that. Do the liberal mainlines have that same issue? Like, do Episcopalians have a...
No. The liberal mainlines get a lot of people. And that's because you don't actually have to be a Christian to be a liberal mainline Protestant.
I feel like I read that there were down to 10 million Episcopalians, and based off actuarial tables, it'll be 5 million in a decade.
I'm not worried about the Episcopalians. What I am worried about is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. There are the ELCA. There are liberal mainline. They're the ones that had that were willing to sign a document with you guys to secure, like, full altar pulpit fellowship with I don't think they did it, but with the Roman Church, saying, hey, we're in full doctrinal agreement, even though, like, we're not.
So,
like, we can't be, because our confessions clearly repudiate the papacy. So, like,
so when in the immediate post-Vatican II era, the Catholic strategy was, let's play down the differences, and then everyone will just be Catholic, and then it'll be gotcha.
Yeah, that didn't work, did it?
Well, so in individual cases, it did. I've met people who then realized, that was fake. But yeah, I'm gonna stay Catholic. Which, I mean, it's not the most dignified thing. But if we look over Christian history and say, well, that seems undignified, we're gonna find a lot that quantitative judgments aren't. Yeah, we can leave that aside.
And the ELCA strategy, was a lot the same. When they formed, they started immediately pursuing, they're in full fellowship with, like, Methodists, that the United Methodist Church, which, as far as I know, absolutely denies the real presence of Christ in the sacrament. They say that it's like a spiritual memorial. And the ELCA, who does not believe that at all, well, supposedly.
Well, Well,
you know, they're like, hey, whatever, we're down with that. So like their thing was also very much the same, was basically if we just pretend like we jive with everything, maybe we'll grow. It worked for them. It worked for them, but it's easy to scratch itching ears, you know?
Yeah. And it's also easy to say, well, we want to be chums, and therefore we're going to pretend that we agree. And it's like, well,
right. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure that if you have undiagnosed PTSD from World War II, that all of this makes sense. So I don't hold it against any of these people that they made mistakes. But the tendency to say, okay, so if we want to not hate each other, we have to pretend that we don't disagree, or that we're saying basically the same thing. It's like, well, there is a huge core of agreement. But if you want to say that, and the differences from that are insignificant, like, is it though?
Okay, so here's my plan, Chad. Here's my plan. You be the next pope. I'm going to be the next presiding pastor of all Lutherans everywhere, the next bishop of all Lutherans.
Mm.
And you and I think we've had the most ecumenical discussions that any Lutheran Catholic have ever had in the past 500 years. Mm. We'll work it out, you and me.
So I mean, we'll still probably disagree, but co-belligerents. We can be co-belligerents against the remaining Methodists. And
I still want to get an Eastern Orthodox guy. You, me, and an Eastern Orthodox guy, and I want to do a podcast called The Ecumenical Council, where all we do is just like dunk on Anglicans all day long. Just like every week we pick a different denomination that isn't one of us and just dunk.
I don't know. Anglicans, the fact that they are so diverse makes it hard to dunk on them in general. Episcopalians, absolutely. But I mean, C.S. Lewis prayed for...
Well, Episcopalian, they're like a subset of Anglican, right?
Yeah.
Like American Anglicans.
Yes. After the Revolution, the Americans like, well, we can't say we're the Church of England anymore. That would be imprudent. And so they're like, oh, we're Episcopalians. And so we have bishops and so on. And we're in communion with the Church of England, but we're not the Church of England. Please don't lynch us. I mean, if you've got C.S. Lewis in your camp, part of me is like, okay, so there's good fruit occasionally. But then again, it's like, but the Episcopalians.
I once came under some fire for saying that my biggest problem with Anglicans is that they don't believe anything. And I had an Anglican come back at me and he said, well, that's not fair. We have the 11 points of whatever in Anglicanism, or the articles, or the 11 articles or whatever it is. And I said, do you believe those? Do you hold to those? And he said, well, no, not me personally. And I was like, right, well, like, that's the problem, is that you cannot hold to those and still be an Anglican.
Mm.
You know, in my view, like, if you don't hold to the Lutheran confessions, then you're not a Lutheran. Like, you can't be a Lutheran but also not believe the things Lutherans believe. Mm. And I imagine as a Catholic, it's the same, like, I don't know how you feel precisely about the Sede crowd, but like, how can you deny Catholicism and still be a Catholic?
Yeah, it's a logically incoherent position. Like, if you want to say Pope bad, well, wrong, but if you want to go a route where... So the Sede Wilkantists, for those who don't know, are people who believe that the papacy existed up until about 1965, at which point the Catholic Church went into heresy. And so now the popes since then have been fake popes. Now, the problem with this is that you have to believe that something that happened in your own lifetime, basically, your own living memory, if not your lifetime, you have to believe that God changed his mind then. So the Catholics were right all the way up to then. So every critique up until then was false, but now something's changed, which seems to me not coherent. I'd respect a Mormon more than a Sede Wilkantist.
Also, as a Lutheran, if I could point out, if you really think that it was 1965 that the Pope started being wrong,
well,
beat you to it.
they should logically be Lutherans or Eastern Orthodox.
Yeah.
Or Mormon. Everyone else gets kind of weird. Like, Anglicans, I'll give it to them, but...
Mormons are weird. I would just like to point out, just real quick, Mormons, I have many Mormon friends and I love them to death and they're good people. But Mormonism is a Christian heresy. And if you're a Mormon, I would highly advise you to repent, leave the Mormon church, and come to Christ, because otherwise you're going to hell. You will be cast into outer darkness with weeping and gnashing of teeth. You will not make it to the celestial kingdom of God, no matter how hard you try. Because in Mormonism, the entire focus is on doing enough nice stuff and working hard enough and being a good enough American that you will get to heaven and be with Christ and one day be elevated to a God yourself. And just none of that is true. You can't work hard enough. You can't be a good enough American. You can't be a good enough father. You will never be good enough to get there on your own. And if you think you will, I mean, that's pride. And that's, you know, that's what the devil did.
Yes, and I agree with all of that. And to me, the issue is, if you could earn your way into heaven, yes, you're doing a very good job. The problem is that you can't. Right. None of us deserves heaven. Undoubtedly, among my Mormon friends, it's definitely clear that these are great people. This is a subculture that has a lot going for it. And as a subculture, I love it. As a theology, it's like, well, this is not just wrong, this is damnably wrong. This is, irrecoverably wrong. And it comes down to the Trinity. You have to accept the Trinity. You have to have a Trinitarian baptism. The reason why I'm optimistic about many Protestants, I'd by no means say all Protestants are going to heaven, but that's not my department. The reason I'm optimistic about many Protestants getting to heaven is that baptism does save. Baptism and then continual repentance. But the baptism has to be Trinitarian. You have to accept the Trinity. This is the non-negotiable part. This is why there will be, according to Catholicism, there will be non-Catholics who get to heaven. There'll be Catholic ones that get there, but it's a bigger thing than that. This is, I believe, why Lutherans would say, well, some Catholics can be saved. It's like, well, look, if you have the Trinity and you have repentance.
I would say a lot of Catholics. I would even be hesitant. I would declare the office of papacy to be antichrist, and I would even with that still be very, very hesitant to say that a pope wouldn't make it to heaven. I can't believe that you can truly be repentant, love and serve Christ, be baptized, and not get there. You know what I mean?
It's what you're running into problems with. Now, the reason why a baptized person would go to hell is if they had something where they're like, well, I don't actually think that that was a sin. And so catechesis is more important than I think people realize. If somebody has an abortion, they're like, well, there was nothing wrong with that. And then they die, and they're like, yeah, that part was fine. I'm sorry for the other things I've done, but I'm not sorry for that. That was the correct answer. Well, sorry. I suspect the Lutheran might have a slightly different take, but...
Slightly different. I would say, oh, it's tough. So, we don't have mortal and... What is it? Mortal and venial sin? Is that...
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have that. We don't have that view. We have unrepentant sin, which would probably be like mortal sin.
So, not quite an analog, but...
I mean, it's closer to to mortal sin than I think venial sin. But we would, I would say if you, all right, let's tackle the gay issue. So like if you're gay and you say, I'm a Christian and I do all the stuff and I believe all the things and I've been baptized and I go to church and this and that, and I know what the Bible says about homosexuality, but I don't think that's right. I think being gay is perfectly fine, and I'm gonna do everything like I should except for this one thing. I would call that an unrepentant sin, because you know what the book says, you know what you're doing, and you're choosing to ignore it and do your own thing anyway. That's an unrepentant sin that will send you to hell. On the other hand, if you are doing something and you truly do not know, like you truly have no idea that it's wrong, and you do repent of your sins, known and unknown, the things you've done and the things you failed to do, and you're truly sorrowful over your sin, and you truly want to do right, I don't know that having done a thing, like, let's say, so I swear a lot. I don't think swearing is wrong. But if it were brought to my attention that swearing is in fact morally wrong, ethically wrong, and it were shown to me how, you know, that's something I would be willing to repent of and put behind me. And it's something that, to a degree, you know, I want to swear less than I do. I don't want to be foul-mouthed, you know, I don't want to be foul-mouthed, but at the same time, like, the occasional ass, I don't think is going to send me to hell. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
I think a lot of it is going to be in the attitude of the heart. I think a lot of it is in the attitude of the heart.
Yes. The Catholic perspective is, so you've got mortal versus venial, but that's not quite the fundamental of that for this purpose. It's that if you die with unabsolved mortal sin, you go to hell. So mortal sin would be a serious thing, like an abortion, let's say.
Right.
If you and there will be Catholics who will be like, well, I'm not going to confess that because I don't actually think that's a sin. And well, you don't have that these days because self-selection and attrition out of church has people right. who have that mindset just disaffiliate. But in the olden days when it was Catholic Rotary Club or Irish Rotary Club, there would be people who did this. And it's like, well, look, then you don't actually get forgiveness in that case. And you can be forgiven of sins without confession. But what you need in that case is perfect contrition, which is, you're not sorry because you're afraid of hell. You're sorry just because you offended the person you love, who is God. And so you have to have that purity of heart, being sorry to God, surely because you've offended him, and not because you're going to go to hell, but because it offended him. And so when I say I'm optimistic about a lot of Protestants, it's like, well, can you get to that place where you're sorry to God because you offended him?
Oh, yeah.
And if you're there, now that takes a lot of spiritual development. But if you can get there, then it's like, okay, well, they should still become Catholic. They're going to feel like chumps in purgatory, but they're going to make it.
It's one of those things you say it takes a lot of spiritual development, but also at the same time, it's one of those things that I feel like doesn't take a lot of spiritual development because it's like, it also feels like one of those things where it's like faith like a child, right? Like it's like that meme, the graph meme, the bell curve meme, you know, where like you start out in the right place and then you think yourself to the wrong place. And then with enough, you get back to the right place.
Yeah. This is available without, I mean, God dispenses his graces as he will. So if you've gotten to that level, congratulations. But it can require lots and lots of trying to get there. But well worth it. I'm not going to say this is the end all be all, but if you can apologize to God for what you've done, just out of knowing that it offends him, and with no thought of hell, that is a good spiritual milestone. That feel when a great spiritual milestone is met by every 5-year-old.
Yeah.
Who's raised in the faith.
Yeah. It is. In Lutheranism, in our confessions, we define repentance, very specifically as contrition over sin and faith in the forgiveness of Christ. And so that's the thing for us. And it's, you know, it's funny. I was actually listening to a Lutheran pastor talk about this because there's a lot of times where you don't feel like you're contrite and it's not about how you feel, or maybe you are really truly contrite. You're brokenhearted. Excuse me. You are truly brokenhearted, but you don't feel forgiven. And again, it's not about how you feel, you know. If you confess and believe, that's where we're at on this thing. In the Lutheran Church, that's where we're at.
So the Catholics also have have something along these lines where, look, if the sacrament has been administered by a priest, it's real. You can feel like, well, wait, I robbed a bank and I've just got two Hail Marys. That seems kind of like a light penance. It's like, well, it can. However, we can't emotionally perceive the efficacy of God's forgiveness. We can have a positive emotional response. When you trust that God has done something, you can absolutely get enthusiastic about that. But your emotions aren't proof about whether this has happened or not. Your emotions are not.
Yeah. And that's such a big trap, I think, of American evangelicalism in general, is that it's so emotion heavy and emotion reliant that, you know, you have to feel forgiven. You have to feel contrite. You have to feel forgiven. And if you don't, then you're not. And it's such a terrible way to be in the faith, because you're never going to feel the right way.
If when it's reduced to emotions, this is why we have the rise of secularism, because secularism can give you much better emotions, honestly. I don't know what music they play at evangelical churches, but my assumption is that you can have a better endorphin rush from basically any sin.
Probably.
And there's zero stigma attached to sin in the culture today. So it's, emotion. It's fine.
Yeah.
When you remove catechesis and you rely on emotion, the 21st century breaks through.
So, here's a question. Mm-hmm. Are we, as Christians, responsible for the culture, and should we be trying to change or influence it, or should we just let the world do what it's going to do, and we do what we're going to do?
So, I'm not anti-Benedict option, but I think it needs to be rethought in certain ways. I feel like your question's adjacent to that, right?
Yes.
If we can turn, let's say, pick a state, let's say Iowa, into Utah but for Lutherans, and we can turn another state into Utah but for Catholics, if we could do that and we had a robust federalism, I'd say, okay, well, in practical terms, that can work. But what is it going to work for? The goal can't be, well, we want world domination. It's like, well, I mean, if Christianity has world domination, that's good, but that's not the goal. The goal is heaven. Everything else is a means to get to heaven, and of bringing people to heaven. So let's say you start a compound and that it doesn't end up being a cult, which, spoiler alert, if you start a compound for whatever religion, no matter how awesome you are, it's going to end up a cult. Well, you're going to get Waco'd. But failing that, you're probably going to become, you're going to have a sex pest going around. So compound's bad. Because there's never been a time that this has happened and then it didn't become a weird cult.
Yeah.
If we could do it, it'd be awesome, but we can't.
Or we're too wicked.
So it's our own fallenness, but it's also, would you like to retreat from a world that feeds children pornography? Yes. But can we retreat from a world where there are homeless people who need sandwiches? Like, you can't withdraw from that world. You can't retreat from the poor. You can't say, well, I've got a compound, I've built all my denomination city in, let's say, rural Ohio. Well, does that mean that you don't have obligations towards everything surrounding you? No. You still have to interact with them. You still have to, we still have corporal works mercy. We still have to instruct the ignorant. We have to counsel the doubtful. We have to give food to the hungry, drink to the thirsty. All of that's still going. All of that's still mandatory. And so my worry with Benedict option communities is that if you look at the people who'd be doing this, these are going to be upper-class people who are siphoning away their talents into building a community and then having nothing to do with the outside world. Even if that's successful, which, highly dubious, but even granting that that's successful, is that caring for the needy? Because I don't... If we were to build Tradistan, or what would be a fun name for a Lutheran city?
I don't know.
But,
Rightistan. We're Correctistan.
Mm, Correctistan, Wisconsin. Population, zero. my suspicion is that any Christian group that goes and builds a city is going to have basically zero homeless population in that city, and that's not because we've taken care of them. It's because no homeless people happen to be a part of that community.
Right.
So the first church I attended was downtown, in downtown Austin. And so I got to go to Mass with homeless people and then talk to them afterwards, same as everyone else. They were integrated into a community. You have homeless people who are Catholic homeless, and you're a fellow parishioner with them. Mm. I go to non-downtown parishes, and then it's like, okay, why am I seeing a BMW in the parking lot of a church? So, one, I don't like that. And that's not me bashing my co-religionists, because my suspicion is that there's no denomination where a wealthy area parish won't have conspicuous consumption in automobiles.
Right.
There's also, if your church doesn't have a member who's a homeless local, something about that seems wrong to me. Now, do we go and kidnap homeless people and then stick them on sidewalks in various communities? No, that's not good. But if the sort of people who would sort themselves out into a community based on faith are probably coming from places where it's like, well, I don't encounter homeless people in my day-to-day life, because it's easy not to.
It's, you know, and it's an interesting point too, because I don't know, it also feels so uniquely American to have this sort of, it's okay for me to have nice things, and it's okay that I drive a BMW, and surely it's not morally wrong to drive a BMW. I don't think that's the case, but it's interesting that we are okay with parishioners that do, like, I don't want to upset anyone, but like, you don't see wealthy members in the early church. There were wealthy people. There were surely wealthy people, but once they joined the church, their goal was to give their wealth, as much of it as they possibly could, to the poor. And in America, that feels very much to be as much of it as I possibly can, within reason, as long as I'm still comfortable, to the poor. And it's not, I'm going to give this wealth as much as I can so that I become poor with them, you know, but we're all eating. I don't know. It does feel different today.
It's I'm not going to say that driving a BMW is a mortal sin in Catholic terms. But it's, if you are spending more on having nice things than you are on having homeless people or the sick or whatever, I mean, you can really break out what's a luxury expenditure. And if that's greater than your contributions, which, as best as I can tell from publicly reported data about charitable giving in this country, basically middle-class people don't give much. The poor give a higher percentage of their income than middle-class people do. And then rich people give plenty, but say, well, if I've already got a $1 billion yacht like Jeff Bezos, well,
yeah,
everything else is fine with me. But if you're, I think the numbers are between 50 and 250, you've got the lowest percentage of your income that you're giving. And it's like, well, if you're eating at Chipotle every day, and then you're driving a car that costs twice as much as you could get by on, and then these extras exceed the amount that you're giving to charity, I'm not going to say that's a sin. I'm going to say that I lift an eyebrow and wonder about...
There's room for improvement.
Yes. And I'm definitely not claiming any particular high ground. I've been convinced of Christianity for 3 years, and so it's a gradual process. There are habits. I'm claiming no high ground. I'm a worse sinner than anybody listening to this, so that's not the angle I'm coming from.
And it's also worth noting, too, that giving more to the poor isn't going to make you any more or less saved or anything like that. But like, these are things we're called to do, and they're things that we should definitely consider in our own life, you know.
If I have a few bucks in my wallet and on my way to work, I stop at an intersection with a guy begging for money, I don't want to give him the $2 or $3 in my wallet because I think, well, when I get to work, I'm going to want to get something out of the drink machine. But like, I'm already fat and I don't need a high sugar Coca-Cola out of the drink machine. This guy does need some food and money will help him facilitate that. So like it, I mean the, you know, and so for me to weigh in favor of myself in that situation doesn't seem correct. And I'm not saying that I make the correct choice every time. I fail that choice most days because there's a lot of homeless people that I just don't help when I could. And I don't know. I think it's important to recognize that we could all be doing more. We could all be doing better. Does that make sense? Did any of that make sense?
I mean, we have responsibilities to the poor, but we also have responsibilities to our family. And so the family responsibilities do come first.
Yeah.
I'm just suspicious of, not anybody in particular, but in the aggregate, when we have so much conspicuous consumption, when most churches don't have any homeless members, it's like, okay, it's not a sin, but it's a red flag. It's like, how many homeless people have attended this church in the last month? And if the answer is zero, it's a red flag.
Yeah. I will say we usually have a homeless person every Sunday at our church. Part of that is where we're located. Part of that may just be they have like a network and word gets around. But I don't think I hardly ever, there's one guy that I see probably twice a month that he comes, probably once or twice a month I see the same guy. He comes in late. He sits in the back. He's a nice guy. But I'd say just about every Sunday we have a revolving cast of local people that will come by, sometimes with families. Mm. And they're polite and they sit through the service. And then, you know, they ask for help. And that's fine. And that's what we're supposed to do, you know, and we help those people.
I certainly don't think that we're called to live the Book of Acts style life today.
Right. Where we all just sell everything.
Mm. Yeah. It's a,
It's a different time.
Yeah. It's a, that's a very particular calling that, I mean, it still exists today, but it's not a universal.
It's a very difficult thing. And I don't want to make people that are quote unquote nominal Christians feel like they're not saved because, I mean, that's certainly the majority, I think, of Christendom are the people that it's like, look, you know, I go to work for 10 hours a day. I work myself to the bone so that I can put my kid through college. I go to church every Sunday and I love my wife and I pay my taxes. And you know what, guy? Like, that's good. That's perfect.
Yeah.
That's good. But there's people out there that are certainly church is an ornament for them and they are pursuing their own gain and their own means and church is just a decoration for their life.
So no doubt that exists, but morally I think if you're a politician who doesn't really believe but you go to church for optics, that's bad, but you might click into it someday. And so attend without believing, just don't receive communion without believing. Don't do that. But a politician who does it as window dressing, I'm not that frightened for because it's like, well, I'd rather have you than not have you.
At least you're hearing it.
Yeah. Whereas if you get into Christianity, it's like, I'm going to go to a evangelical seminary and then I'm going to plant a church and I'm going to become a billionaire. It's like, well, look.
Yeah.
My dude, if your personal wealth, as you spread the gospel, if your personal wealth reaches that level. Now, if your ministries reach that level, and it's like, well, you've raised $1 billion for a famine. Okay, awesome. Great is your reward. If you have personal wealth like that, I'm not sure if you're going to make it. I'm not saying anybody's not making it. I'm saying that there are cases where it's like, well, I'm not sure about that. And other people are just like, yeah, I'm pretty good. Yeah.
So, oh man, now I kind of want to Now I kind of want to pull up like random megachurch pastors on YouTube and just see like what we get. Because God, there are so many of those people. There are so many of those people. I got I drew some consternation for coming down on. There's a guy that planted a church in my town, and it's a church called the River House. And the guy had training, but not really. He didn't have any training, and it's you know, I'm sure he's a nice guy, and I'm sure he loves Jesus, but he went to like a 6-month, like, non-denominational Protestant intensive and then planted a church. And like, that's not, you know, that's not okay.
Yeah, we don't love to see that.
No. No. We're in the Lutheran church, and I believe also the Catholic church. I mean, you know, we say seminary, but when we say seminary, we're talking like you have to have a master's degree.
So Catholics, like, it's
graduate level.
Yeah. The Catholics, it's slightly weird. Basically, you go through a vetting process first for 1,000 things. It's a, and so then you go through, classically you went through minor seminary and then major seminary. But basically you're in college and subject to orders from the bishop for 5 to 8 years, usually right. 7. If you convert or if you decide that you have a vocation, you've already got a master's. Well, the fastest you can go is 5. And so all the priests get a master's, but there's tons of other stuff that goes into it.
Yeah.
It's a undergrad plus, I think a safe rule would be to say undergrad plus 5 years.
Okay.
And so it's like, okay, this is, and Jesuits have 12 years of formation. So it's not just academic. It's, if somebody starts a church because they're like, well, I'm academically gifted. that's good, but this is not sufficient. This right. is not, it will never be sufficient to, we need you. No, I mean, we'll have our different gifts, but to be the leader of a church, you need several different gifts, and academics is arguably not the most important thing.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all. There's a lot of people that worry that our seminaries are training theologians, but not necessarily pastors. Like, it's great that you speak Greek and Hebrew, and those things are certainly necessary. But it's different to look at someone when, you know, their spouse or their child or their parent has just died, and to sit with them. Like, that's a different thing. That's a different thing than being able to quote the entire Athanasian Creed in Latin.